Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
All right. So we talked about repeated measures analysis variance. Sorry, about factorial analysis variance last time. Now, this would be for a... If you had, and we talked about this, if you had a three-way design, so three independent variables, now it becomes... Now you just thought you've got gamma in here. So x equals mu plus alpha plus beta plus gamma plus alpha beta plus alpha gamma plus beta gamma plus alpha beta gamma plus epsilon. In other words, you've got three main effects, alpha, beta, and gamma, A, B, and C. You've got an A, B, an A, C, and a B, C interaction, and an A, B, C interaction. Right? So it really, and you could keep adding, you could put a delta in there, and it gets bigger and bigger. The point is that once you know how to do this with two variables, you can do it with three, four, five, etc. I've once read a paper that had a four-way interaction that actually I could understand and the authors could interpret. It's very difficult to interpret such things. So that, like a three-way interaction looks like this. Notice what's happened here is you have a two, you have an A by B interaction at C1, but it's a different-looking interaction at C2. So the two-way interactions have changed depending upon the level of a third variable. So, you know, a 728-way interaction is the 727-way interactions changed at some at levels of the 728th variable. Right? So it's really a very general thing. This is something you might actually see. Like, this would be something, would be, if you put this in some context, it's not that bad if you think of some variables. You get up to four, it gets very complicated. I think the one I saw was spatial ability versus verbal ability. That was one. So it's a kind of test type. Sex, handedness, and, oh God, what was the fourth variable? Yeah. No, they were. It was a four-way interaction, and I think it was sexual orientation. I think that's what it was. And you could look at that and go, okay, I see why that might happen. I think that's what it was. It's something Richard Harshman, my old stats prof, actually, at Western, when I was an undergrad, some stuff he did. He was an interesting guy. He didn't have a BA or a master's degree, just a PhD. Yeah, he just had a PhD because he dropped out of school because it was the 60s and it was cool to drop out of school. But he thought, well, I've corrected how factor analysis is done. Maybe I'll submit this to a journal. As an undergrad, he wrote a paper correcting how factor analysis was done. So he sent it to his journal. Because I went and asked him after class, I said, in the calendar it says you only have a PhD. How is that possible? Is that a misprint? He said, no, the way it works. And he was always kind of like this, you know. You never would have known he would have sort of dropped out in the 60s. It was perfect. It was great. And he said, I submitted this paper, and they said it's a horrible journal article, but it'd make a great PhD thesis. Would you like to do a PhD with me? This is your thesis. Just do the coursework. You'll be done in 2 years. So that's what happened to this guy. He used to do the strangest things. He'd talk about, he'd show like the numbers, like on a three-way table like that. He'd say, what Bob Dylan song does this remind you of? And we're all looking at him. He says, you know that something's happening, but you don't know what it is. So he was a cool guy. He was a great, great professor. These kind of designs have their advantages. And we can study interactions is the key. I mean, I talked the other day about implicit versus explicit memory and retention interval. Those are interactions we would predict. And levels of processing. If you put those three together, you predict an interaction. You think about something like verbal versus spatial ability, like scores on verbal versus spatial ability, and sex. You predict an interaction there. Like, that's what you actually predict. So when you say males are better at spatial, females at verbal, oh, you just told me there was going to be an interaction, right? You're actually predicting that. So oftentimes, while sometimes it's hard to put these things sort of into context, think about almost anything you know in psychology. Frankly, in almost any of the life sciences, certainly in biology in general, when you think about it, you're often saying, under these conditions, this happens, but under these conditions, something else happens. You're always saying that kind of thing, right? And that's what an interaction is statistically, right? So many, many theories in behavioral sciences, life sciences, have interactions in them. They may not specifically say the word interaction, but even think of a giant thing like, you know, the whole, quote, nature-nurture thing. What's nature-nurture? The answer to that question is it's an interaction of nature and nurture. Right? It's not nature, it's not nurture, it's an interaction. You're actually saying the things themselves aren't as interesting as the way the two come together. That's an interaction. So a lot of the theories we have in life science in general are about interactions. Once you've done it a few times, they're actually relatively simple to interpret. And if you think of almost anything you like in psychology, you know, if you like memory stuff, think about implicit versus explicit and retention interval. That implicit doesn't decay, explicit does. Oh, that was an interaction. It's not that hard to interpret them if you have done it a couple of times. Right, so that's not really a horrible thing to do. Now, there's disadvantages, of course. Is it a fixed model, a random model, or a mixed model? And we kind of almost ignore that. What we tend to do is say things are fixed unless they're explicitly random. Unless they're explicitly random, and there very rarely are in the kind of work that we end up doing. Unless you're doing field work. Yeah, Mike?
With mix, is there a reason why the expected values change?
Yeah, because of the math behind it. I mean, it's
I was looking at that.
Because what you've done is you've brought in a new level of randomness because you're making predictions based not only on the random nature of the dependent variable, but also the random nature of the variables that you've picked, the levels of the variable you've picked. And the calculus behind it changes the expected values. Yeah. If you really are interested, I can lend you a book. Okay. Yeah. It's not like some sort of weird quantum effect where I looked at it and everything changed. You know, it's not like Schrodinger's cat or something. These can get huge fast, right? So if you've got four levels, it gets big. If you've got five, well, I'll just show you quickly how big something like this can get. So if we just had a two-way, we had an A and a B, we got A and B and A by B. That's easy. Now if we have C, we get CA, CB, and C, A, B. Good? Okay. Now let's put D in. D, A, D, B, D, A, B, D, C, D, C, A, D, C, B, D, C, A, B. So now with four variables, we've got what? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14. We have 15 terms. You're gonna, if you put E in now, you're going to double it, plus one. So this thing can, now suddenly you're doing 15 F ratios here. That's kind of crazy. So I would suggest never doing anything bigger than 3. And I would suggest for those of you that are thinking of doing the honors thesis, don't do anything with more than 2. Like I said, I don't let my students use more than 2 variables typically. Just because I can't, unless I'm really intimately knowledgeable about some literature, I have really real trouble thinking that way. And I think most people do. It just gets too complicated.
What's your limit to the amount of levels you want to
use? Well, and then, you know, think about subjects. If we've got A by B by C by D, and we want to put, let's say, for reasonable power, you need about 12 subjects per cell. So now you've got, let's say it's just 2. So it's a 2 by 2 by 2 by 2. You've got what? What's that? 2, 4, 8, 16 times 12. 146 people. That's a lot of people. Well, yeah, but you got to keep people there all day. You know, it becomes unwieldy. You got to worry about all that crap too. Yeah, exactly. So it's one of these cases where it can get silly. So just keep that in mind. I mean, one of the things that people often think of doing when they know how to do these techniques is, oh, let's throw in another variable. It's like, no, let's just do another experiment some other time. That's what a PhD thesis is for. You don't do it all with one experiment, right? You do this experiment where you use A and B, and now another, maybe A, B, and C, and the next experiment you're going to use maybe A, B, and C in a different context, and now you're going to use A, B, and D, and then D, B, and C, and then D alone. That's how you tend to do science, because that also throws in some replication. So it just can get too big. That's sort of the downside. And that's it for those designs. So let's hide that. Hey, look, there they are. Yay. Now, where are we here? He's off in the corner. He's right there, actually. It's because the monitor resolution changes. Yeah, a lot of those people that were saying, where's Sidney Crosby? Why isn't Sidney Crosby doing well? Where's Sidney Crosby? Sidney Crosby isn't doing anything. He won the gold medal. So stop your whining.
Had he not scored that gold, it would have...
Yeah, and if my grandmother had wings, she'd be an eagle. I mean, those kind of things, And you knew he was going to score, too.
That's so easy to say now, though.
No, it was Sidney Crosby.
No, it's
like when Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux broke in 87 when they were coming down against the Russians on a 3-on-2 with Dale Hawerchuk. You thought, oh, well, the game's over, because Gretzky's going, let's see, who will I pass the puck to? Oh, Mario's behind me. it's just a gimme. And if you watch the highlight, you can actually hear Jerome McGinley, you can hear Crosby yell, Iggy, to Jerome McGinley to get the puck. And Ginla said, I've heard that yelled thousands of times in my career, but never with that much urgency. I knew I had to get Sid the puck. Well, the coach of the Penguins said, as soon as Crosby took the puck on the boards, he said, I knew it was over. And he's an American. He said, I was cheering for the States. Letterman last night actually said he was cheering for Canada because he wanted to hear our national anthem again. Then he sang the Canadian national anthem. I love David Letterman.
When we lost to them the first time, they showed Ryan Burke. I was like, okay, he needed a win.
Yeah, exactly, because they get so few. Ron Wilson probably went back to his team between the third period and overtime and said, guys, I coach the Leafs. I need a win. give me something. All right, let's talk about repeated measures designs. Basically here, let's say you're thinking about something like learning or forgetting, right? Well, I guess forgetting is kind of the opposite of learning. But, same kind of question. Where you can't really use independent groups. It's kind of hard to do. Because I want to know the process of forgetting forgetting is about how things change over time. So, I guess I could have, give you four guys here a list of words and you four guys here a list of words. And I test you at 5 minutes and I test you at 1 hour. I guess I could do that. But when we're talking about forgetting, we're really talking about change over time or learning. Would I give you guys just one time to study and you guys 10 times? It doesn't seem like I'm really comparing learnings is within an organism, right? Independent groups, I guess you could do it, but it doesn't sound appealing because you're kind of missing the point in a lot of respects of what learning is or what forgetting is. I think the most sensible thing to do would be to test the same people over and over again, right? So instead of having 8 of you, maybe I just take 4 of you and I test you after 1 time studying, 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times if I'm doing learning, or I give you 1 time to study and then I test you after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever, for forgetting. And you all know this is done. So what you're doing is you're looking at change over time. Right? You're looking at change over time. So you get something that looks like this. Let's say we're doing, the classic kind of memory experiment where I give you a list of words and I give you retention intervals of 5 minutes, 1 hour, and 24 hours. So there's your independent variable. Your dependent variable now, and you measure the same group, group one, group one, group one, each time. Right? So now I'm measuring the same group at 5 minutes, at 1 hour, and 24 hours. Right? Make sense? Not so bad. And this kind of design obviously is going to be used a lot, especially, say, in learning experiments. I think back to all the stuff I did for my PhD work. It was always like this. That one of the variables was always time. Had to be, because I was studying learning and forgetting. Now, you should be able to detect a problem here if you've been thinking about this a little bit. The observations aren't independent, and I'm always telling you the one thing you can never violate is that if I know Danielle's score, I can't know Stephanie's score. The scores must be independent. The problem is, if I know Danielle's score at 5 minutes, I get a pretty good idea how she's going to, and her ranking, let's say, I know how she's going to do probably at 1 hour and 24 hours. Danielle's scores depend on all of the other scores because they're all Danielle. Ooh, and that's a key thing. We can't violate that. I keep saying, we can't violate that assumption. There's no way. Right? Well, you know what you could do? You could just throw that in the model. I could think of another variable, and I'll call it subjects. Or I'll call it people. And it's got three levels, four levels. Its levels are Tina, Danielle, Stephanie, and Mike. So our model now looks like this. X equals mu plus tau. Tau, this is now back, look, because remember, that's a one-way analysis of variance. So tau for treatment. So any score equals the grand mean, you know that's going to be there, plus the treatment effect, you know that's going to be there because, again, it's just this was just an independent, a one-way analysis of variance. The only difference we did is we now have what? The same subjects tested three times instead of three groups of subjects. We still have error. The only new thing we have is pi for the effect of subjects. I think of pi for people. I figure that's probably why they chose that. Right? Because it's the Greek letter pi, and it makes a p sound. And we all love pi. I like pie better than cake. I do, just generally. I'd rather eat steak, though, than any other dessert. I'd rather, what do you want for dessert? Another strip loin?
Or bacon.
Well, actually, you can make the chocolate dip bacon. Oh. No, you take really thick bacon and you got to get it. You put it in the oven so you get it really crispy and kind of even, and then you dip it in chocolate, let the chocolate harden, and thank me later. It is outstanding. No, that's a very trendy thing right now too. I watch the Top Chef. I know these things. I watch me the.
Dave, you've been doing that for years.
Yeah. Oh, I've just been eating piles of bacon and chocolate. I'm not denying that. No, chocolate bacon ice cream is a big thing. There's a reason I don't have an ice cream maker, because you'd have to roll me to work every day. Or a deep fryer, because I'd be making deep fried chocolate bacon ice cream. Yeah. You ever get the deep fried ice cream? Take the ice cream, make it really, yeah, isn't it good? Oh. You take ice cream really, really, really hard, and then you put batter on it, you deep fry it. How bad can that be? It isn't. It's awesome. Now, the only reality TV shows I watch have to do with cooking, except for The Amazing Race. I always imagine Paul Dupuy and I as a team on The Amazing Race. We wouldn't go very far, because, I don't think we're in great shape, and we'd be real smart asses to people. People we'd be mocking their intelligence. We'd be mocking each other. I'd get a sunburn everywhere. Paul would be winded all the time. But we'd be a very entertaining team. We'd probably last about two legs. Right?
Get the archery challenge,
right? Yeah, archery, yeah. I'd get something like, oh, good. I've got a... Okay. Well, I'd be okay with those high up in the air things, because I can't see the ground, so it wouldn't be a big thing. But I think we'd be pretty good, because I think we'd be funny.
Yeah, Paul would last two legs. You'd die after the first.
Well, from the sunburn. Yeah. Or I'd be walking around on the archery thing going, what the hell's going on here? And someone from Big Brother hits me through the head with with an arrow. But I think we'd be funny, mocking people without them knowing it. I think that'd be a lot of fun. Or just things like that. All right. Where the hell was I and why did that happen? Right, so, yeah, effective subjects. Pi, that's where it came from. Then I went to the dessert thing and we talked about bacon. Okay. Right?
What is it really saying?
Sorry, go ahead.
Did you get each subject in each condition?
No, it's not saying that yet. What it's saying is that we can consider people like a variable. So, and they are really. Right? I mean, if we want to talk about different levels of people, of humanness, you're the Mike level, you're the Stephanie level, you're the Danielle level, and you're the Tina level. Right? So if we're going to... Then, if we put that in the model, now we don't have to worry about the independence anymore. because we've actually put it in. The problem you couldn't have non-independent observations was because there was no way we could put it in the model. It wasn't there, so it would violate the assumption that every source of variation is in the model.
So would you take the average of their score across all measures, and then that's where that comes in?
In essence, that's what you're doing, because when you would do a sum of squares for subjects, okay, and a mean squared for subjects, and you'd be taking your individual scores across all three retention intervals in this case, and then you'd be subtracting your scores at 5 minutes, 1 hour, and 24 hours from that, if you're going to calculate the sum of scores.
From the meat of 5 hours.
From the meat of Danielle.
Yeah, or the meat of Danielle.
Yeah, and the meat of Mike and the meat of Stephanie.
And then you look at what's left over, the difference, and see if that's significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you don't really see if it's significant. You know it is. You know you're different from you and you and you.
No, but from myself, right? To find out about the time over.
Yeah, well, we've sucked that variance out.
Right.
Right? Now we can just look purely at 5 minutes, 1 hour, and 24 hours. Mm-hmm. Because we've taken out the variance due to the fact that you're different people.
E just remains constant.
Yeah. Yeah, and error, well, it's not constant. It's different.
No, you know, just, I mean, like.
Yeah, it, everything else has stayed the same. The only thing we've done here is we've actually partitioned. If this is here and this is here, they can't have changed their parameters. The only thing we've made smaller is error. Because where can that pi thing come out of? There's only one place. It can come out of error. So to design now, we have to look at it like this. We'll call them S. S1, S2, S3, S4. So we've decreased error. Right? Because again, think about it. The original model for a one-way ANOVA is this x equals mu plus tau plus epsilon. This really is a one-way ANOVA. We've just put something else in. Well, x is still going to be the same. Mu's not going to change. There's still a treatment effect. Where can that pi come from? The only place it can come from is this. So it's actually going to make it smaller. And you know, that's at the bottom of the F thing. It's going to give us more power. If the bottom part of a fraction gets smaller, the number itself gets bigger. We want a big F ratio. So that's good. The thing is now, we've paid for this with degrees of freedom. Because as you probably know, take a look at an F table, the more degrees of freedom, the smaller the F value you need to get significance. So what we've done now is we've made the degrees of freedom for error smaller. So we've made error smaller, but we've paid for it in degrees of freedom. In other words, so make error smaller, so make F bigger, F's going to get bigger. But the number we have to exceed, the critical value, is actually getting bigger as well. So the question you ask yourself is it worth it? Yeah, that's right. So here we go. Let's take a look at a very, and I haven't put sums of squares in here at all because it's not really, I'm talking about degrees of freedom. Here's the source of variation. We have retention interval and error and total, right? We have 2 degrees of freedom for retention interval. Why is that? Because we have 3 levels. We have 11 total degrees of freedom because there's 12 observations. Well, what do we have for error? 9. So now we're going to be using, if we were using a regular one-way ANOVA, we'd be using F at 2 and 9. And I don't know if anybody has a textbook on them. I don't know what the number, the actual critical value is with 2 and 9 degrees of freedom. Does anybody have it on it, just out of curiosity? Just so you can look it up. So if you get the critical F value for 2 and 9 degrees of freedom at the 0.05 level. Yeah, 2 is the numerator, 9 is the denominator. What is it? 4.26 is 2 and 9? Okay. 4.26, you said? Okay. Leave that open for a second, because take a look now. Now we've got retention interval with 2. Subjects have 3 degrees of freedom because there's 4 subjects. We have a total of 11 observations. Well, it's got to add up. to 11. There's got to be 6 for error. We'll get to why it's 6 later on. But it must be 6 because that's what's left over. So what's the critical value for 2 and 6 degrees of freedom? Got that one?
5.14.
Look, see, it's bigger. So the loss in degrees of freedom for error, thank you very much. The loss in degrees of freedom for the denominator has actually made our critical F value bigger. And you know, the bigger that is, we have to exceed that to get significance, right? We have to exceed that to get significance. So with this one, the number goes up. The critical value is higher. But because we've split error into subjects in error, this number itself is smaller. Yes, Danielle.
Over subjects and error in the second time.
Sure. So subjects, again, and it's got 4 levels because there's 4 people. Right? Mm-hmm. Just think of it like a variable. And if it's got 4 levels, it's got how many degrees of freedom? 3. Right. Now, the design itself still has 11 degrees of freedom because there's 12 observations.
Right.
We've partitioned this thing. It still has to add up to 11. So what's error have to be? It has to be 6. Right? Because 2 and 3 is 5. And what 5 plus what equals 11? 6. So the question then is, if we account for subject variance, we've increased the critical F, but we have decreased the size of mean squared error, the actual number itself. So we've made error smaller, which is good because it's the bottom part of the fraction of the F ratio. The question is, has it made up for the fact that we've lost power because of the loss of degrees of freedom? The answer, by the way, is almost always yes. Under very specific circumstances, maybe sometimes no. But it's almost always better to make errors smaller. If there was no variance due to subjects, then it wouldn't be worth it, probably. All right. So any design has a finite amount of degrees of freedom and variation. So we've partitioned the degrees of freedom and the variation just a little further. That's all we've done here. We've taken a one-way analysis of variance and broken it down a bit more because we have the same subjects, because we can. You can't do this with any analysis of variance one way. You can only do it with one where you have repeated measures. So mean squared for retention interval is going to be the same for both analyses. If you were to run this twice, and you ran it once as a one-way and once as a repeated, as a repeated measures, you'd get the same mean squared for retention interval. So again, the question then is the reduction of mean squared error, because the number itself is going to be smaller, is it worth the loss of degrees of freedom for error? That's the question you have to ask yourself. And again, as I said, the answer is almost always going to be yes. The only way it wouldn't be yes is if the differences between individuals were negligible. If the differences between individuals were virtually nil, were negligible. Because then you've taken out nothing, but you've lost degrees of freedom. Right? So if we had some physiological process, a very basic one, some very basic one, and we put the subjects in there, everybody's going to react exactly the same way. Right? Physiologically, pretty much. Again, something very basic. You'd have to get something exceedingly basic here. In that case, yeah, you wouldn't do it. Let's think about this for a second. Is it realistic, though, to think that x equals nu plus tau plus pi plus epsilon? In other words, is it realistic to think that any score equals... Well, the grand mean, that's fine, that's realistic. The treatment effect plus the subject effect just plus error. Shouldn't you think, in fact, that pi should interact with tau? In other words, in our experiment, the effective retention interval on Tina is going to be different than it is on Danielle. It's going to be different than it is on Stephanie. It's going to be different than it is on Mike. Right? Think about a memory. It's a memory experiment. Some people just have good memories. Memories. Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't even like Barbara Streisand. I really don't. I've never been a fan. It was either that or I started singing Memory by Sugar Cult. And nobody get that. But some people, let's say Stephanie has a kick-ass memory. Like really good, you know? So maybe it doesn't affect her at all. She's just good all the time. Let's say that Danielle, you know, has the sort of standard forgetting curve. You know, starts off pretty well, drops off, and then at 24 hours is pretty low. Right? Let's say that Mike doesn't remember anything ever. So it's just like way down here. And let's say somehow, some weird way, Tina gets better with time. So as time goes by, she remembers things better. If so, we will write that up together and put it in nature. But so somehow hers is actually going up. Oh, let's see. I had one straight down up here, one straight down here, and one going down like that. And one. Does that sound a lot like an interaction? Doesn't that sound like the different levels of people, the effective retention interval? I can't talk about it on its own. I can only talk about it when I say Danielle's like this and Steph's like this and Tina's like that and Mike's like that. Oh, it's an interaction. In fact, it's much more reasonable to say that tau and pi should interact. You ever had a tau pie? Very good. I saw that on a cooking show. No, I didn't. Made that one up. Wasn't funny. Okay. So, in fact, it's sensible to assume that it does. There are very few variables that affect everyone exactly the same way. And, I mean, really what would happen is everybody's memory would decay a little bit, but some people are going to drop off more than others. It's just bound to happen. Right? So, in fact, it's a much safer assumption and a realistic assumption to say, in fact, that tau interacts with pi. Right? The strange thing is, this doesn't actually change much. It doesn't change much. But not out. Our model changes. It changes the model, but it doesn't actually change the math behind it. And you're going to wonder why in the hell we're doing this. Well, we'll see in a sec. Now the model becomes this. X equals mu plus tau plus pi plus tau pi. Yes, Stephanie. It's gone. We've exhausted the degrees of freedom. We've exhausted the variance. We've basically replaced the error term with tau pi. We know there is an effect of individuals, just like with any interaction. There's an effect of A and an effect of B and an effect of A by B. Here we know there's an effect of treatment, an effect of individuals, but there's an individual by treatment interaction. And if we do that, there's no more, the variance is all gone now. Right? We've exhausted the degrees of freedom. There's none left. Why do you think I keep telling you now we're going to partition the degrees of freedom in sums of squares? There's actually a reason I do most of these things. The story is about chocolate dipped bacon notwithstanding. There really is a reason that I do these things. And the reason I was always partitioning degrees of freedom in sums of squares is mostly because of this right now. Because if we're going to split stuff apart, into variance and degrees of freedom into their constituent parts, right? You know it's finite. So eventually, now, if there's nothing left, we can't talk about error anymore. All we're doing now is we're treating S for subjects here, as just some other variable. Because Danielle, when I said, oh yeah, and 6 is left over, you're probably wondering, why is it 6? Because it's a retention interval by subject interaction. 2 times 3 is 6. Just like an A by B interaction, if it was a 3 by 4 design, would have exactly that kind of thing. But unlike a standard sort of two-way analysis of variance, we don't have individual subjects, like say five subjects in the cell, 5 minutes, and the level Danielle of subjects. We have it once. So we don't have anything else to do. We don't have anything else we can call error anymore. So what we have now is retention interval, subjects, and retention interval by subjects, and total. So in fact, the way you calculate these things, it wouldn't have changed, actually. It changed the model. It's making some sense. You see why we changed it and put tau by pi in there? Okay. So how does this work? Well, our error term is actually a treatment by subject interaction. So that thing we called error before, actually what it is treatment by subject interaction. And you've heard about using an interaction term before as an error term. Remember mixed ANOVA? Or not mixed ANOVA, mixed model ANOVA, right? Where you take the fixed factor and you divide it by the interaction. Subjects are a random factor. We treat them as a random factor. One of the few times we worry about this, and again, there's a reason I taught you about fixed effects and random effects, and that's because we treat subjects as a random effect. I know I didn't randomly select these four guys, but it's much closer to random selection than saying 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours for my retention intervals. So we're going to treat subjects as a random factor in a repeated measures design. And the expected values then work out such that we would take the effect for treatment and we would divide it by the interaction effect. We don't test the subject factor, actually. Let me show you. Let's see if I can do this. Expected value for treatments is going to be treatments plus pi plus tau pi. Treatments, the effect for subjects is going to just be pi. The effect for treatment by subject interaction is going to be pi. Is that right? Yes. Plus tau pi. Is that right? No, that's right. Just making sure. I want to make sure I got this right. That is right for sure.
So this is that's that.
Yeah. I think that's just going to be pi, but no, that's 4 on. Which means we take that out. We take that out. That's right. Okay, now I got it. Okay. So now for the F, you can see you're going to divide tau plus tau pi over just tau pi. Right? Great. For subjects, what are you going to do?
You just go tau, the interaction.
You can't. Because you're not isolating pi. There's nothing in the... Yeah, there's no way to test it. There's no error term for it. You can't test if it's significant. It is impossible. It is mathematically impossible. Yeah, subjects. So you just can't do it. For treatment, you can, because you can just divide by the interaction. And you're fine. We can't. It's mathematically impossible to test if there's a subject effect. Now, there's no error term with the correct expected value of the mean square. Okay? There's no error term with the expected value of the mean square. That's life. thinking, yes, but we're leaving a factor sitting there and we haven't tested it. And frankly, who cares? I know Tina, who's no longer here, and Danielle and Stephanie and Mike are different people. I know there are differences between them. So not only can I not test it, I don't give a crap. It just doesn't matter. Why would I test to see that they're different people? Even I can see that. That was a blind joke. Nobody got it? Anyway. So, A, there's no error term, and B, it doesn't matter because we can't test it. We just can't. Right?
I think I chucked in my sweater.
You know the times in school you used to laugh at your teachers and they got chalk on themselves? You pay for it for the rest of your life if you teach. You do. I always tend to wear things like black clothing, too, whenever I'm going to teach something, I'm going to use the blackboard. Because I'm an idiot. And because most of my clothes are black t-shirts.
I think you should use a blackboard every time.
You think so? Let's see these jeans. You see if they look like they might have chalk on them now? Ha-ha! Pretty smart, eh? So, that's why, in fact, you end up doing this subject by retention and role in that case, interaction. Because, well, it makes more sense, and that's why it becomes the error term, because the expected values mean squares. Again, there's a reason I went over all that crap. And finally, there's no expected value, there's no mean square that meets that we could divide by for the subject effect, and we don't care. We just wouldn't care anyway. It can't be done. Let's talk about a different kind of repeated measures type test. Remember the match pairs t-test? So instead of individuals, we got pairs of subjects, let's say. So we find out that Danielle and I are very similar on some variables, so we match us up as a pair. Right? And then you test me in one level and Danielle in another. We just do Dave subtract Danielle. Right? You know, the one we used before, match pairs of subjects. Instead of, you also did that in essence with repeated measures t-test, right, a correlated t-test. But you could also expand that and say individuals that are similar on some variable. Right? Subjects usually matched actually on the dependent variable. So let's say it was blood pressure and we were going to test blood pressure level and with some drug. And we find out through testing that Danielle and I have exactly the same blood pressure. I doubt it. Let's pretend. So testing me with the placebo and Danielle with the drug makes complete sense because we're matched on the dependent variable anyway. We're matched up. Do the same thing with repeated measures ANOVA. Certainly could. Why not? What's stopping you? There's nothing stopping you. What we need is what's called homogeneity of experimental units. Experimental units are subjects, or as the APA calls them, participants. And I think in the next revision, they're going to start calling them unicorns or something, just to make it even less offensive. Lollipops. I had three male lollipops. And their gender, they wouldn't want to say sex because that might offend somebody. And we have to be the same. Homogeneity of experimental units. Now, Danielle, I said pretend we have the same blood pressure. Here now, with that one variable, we have homogeneity of experimental units. And let's say Stephanie has the same blood pressure as the two of us as well. So now instead of doing just two levels, we could do placebo, drug A, drug B. There's a few ways you can achieve this. Matched pairs is the most common way, or matched blocks, I guess you call them. Matched groups. Litter mates, if you're doing anything with animals, you're looking at development, animals from the same litter, just throw that in there. I mean, that's a pretty good variable. Or twins, or triplets in this case, you could do it. Or octomom's kids. Right. So it's something to keep in mind. Cage mates, if you've got rats that are communally housed. A lot of times now what you do, unless you have to house them separately, animal care people, like the rules, like you to house them in a group, which is really stupid, by the way. But they like you to house them in a group because they anthropomorphize and think rats want to be with other rats. I don't know. But they're all living in the same cage, right? A friend of mine was told once to put all his monkeys in the same cage, and he said to the animal care people, like the people that make the rules, you know they're going to fight, right? We keep them in separate, nice big cages with things to do and toys and stuff for a reason. They will fight. Now, the rules clearly say, yeah, and they will fight, and one will die, and it will be your fault, and one die. Because animal care regulations sometimes are really, really stupid, because they think, well, people wouldn't want to be in separate cages. They aren't people. The only thing that's people is people and Soylent Green. Nobody, anything? Soylent Green. Wow. Soylent Green, the movie Soylent Green, Charlton Heston. No. Nothing? No. Well, I'm going to spoil the movie for you now, but clearly none of you care. So it's the future. And they've saved the world's food problem with this wonderful new product, little wafers called Soylent Green. But it turns out, as Charlton Heston says in the last scene in the movie, Soylent Green is people! Yeah.
So. I think I've seen that.
That's a great movie. It's actually a great movie, and now I've wrecked it for you. But 73, something like that. It's a great old sci-fi flick. Yeah, of course, he used to also be in, he was in the original Planet of the Apes. A planet where apes evolved from men? Why, it's absurd! I love Charlton Heston. His politics were weird, but he was a great actor. He played Charlton Heston in every movie he was ever in. He's Moses coming down from the mountain. I've got these commandments, you dirty apes! Like, you can always just think he's going to be in the same movie. It's kind of like, say, Tom Cruise. Or the worst example of that, of course, is what's his name? The guy that was in Dances with Wolves, Kevin Costner. He plays Kevin Costner in every movie he's in. So if you had a whole bunch of movies with Kevin Costner, you could use that. Because it's like just matched pairs. See, I brought it back. See, I did that. So what we're going to be doing here is called blocking. We're putting people into blocks. So when we're blocking on, we'll call it a nuisance variable. Basically, it's a nuisance because it's going to get in the way of the analysis. And it's something we can remove. So if it was the blood pressure example, we think, well, gee, individual starting blood pressures, that's probably going to be very important for how a drug works. Let's put that in. So let's make sure we match these three people up here because they have the same blood pressure. Now we'll find three other people that have the same blood pressure, and there'll be another level, another block of blood pressure. There'll be just a level of a nuisance variable. It's a nuisance variable because you don't actually care about it. It's a nuisance. It gets in the way. This, of course, is going to reduce error, which is going to give us greater power. We want error reduced. The structural model, actually, that comes out is almost the same as the structural model for repeated measures. In fact, you know what? Repeated measures, analysis of variance, I start by talking about it, because it's a little easier to understand, but frankly, repeated measures analysis of variance is a special case of a blocking analysis of variance. Because the ultimate block is using the same subject over and over again. Right? So it looks like this. X equals mu plus tau plus pi plus error. So any score equals the grand mean plus the treatment plus the block plus the residual, what's left over. So this is why, in fact, I start with that other model when I do the repeated measures, because, in fact, that's where you'd go with this. But so now pi, instead of being for people, is for blocks. And I can't believe no one's seen Soylent Green. Weird. Isn't anybody here like a science fiction geek at all? Really? You've never seen Soylent Green? Oh, wow, you really, well, I've wrecked the movie for you now, obviously, but. Yeah, because I thought you were. I thought you'd get that. I looked over at you like, you're going to get that one. Okay. You've been watching Caprica, that new, the prequel to Battlestar Galactica?
I haven't had time.
Make time. Just saying.
Is it good?
Oh. It's like they took Battlestar Galactica and took out all the space battles. So. But it's cool. Like, it's a whole universe and stuff, so it's kind of cool. It's about the invention of the Cylons.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. Yeah. One of the characters is a little kid, and his name is William Adama. It's Commander Adama as a child. Awesome. So, there's assumptions about this model, about the randomized block. First of all, the sum of the treatment effects equals zero. Yeah, that always is the case. Remember, the sum of the alphas and the sum of the betas was zero. Sum of the treatment effects is zero. In other words, if it's going to raise you up in one level, it's got to lower you up in another level. Lower you up, lower you down in another level. So it all sums to zero. That's always the case. Here's where it gets a little different. The blocks are normal. The effect of blocks is normal and independent with a mean of zero and a variance of sigma squared sub pi. We just have to give it a number. The error, the residual, is normal and independent with a mean of zero and a variance of sigma squared sub epsilon. The error, the residual, is independent of the block. That's in capitals. It's a really important thing. And the way you would detect if error wasn't independent of residual, in fact, would be to look for a tau by pi, in other words, treatment by block interaction. If you see a treatment by block interaction, that means the error depends upon the block, right? And you wouldn't want that. Because it's not in the model. Unlike when it's repeated measures and we know it's the same person, we can make that assumption and deal with it. We can't in this more general case of the randomized block. The math just doesn't work out. And you think about it, it's an untenable assumption. If it's Mike every single time, that's fine. But if it's me, Danielle, and Stephanie, and we're matched only on one thing, which is, say, the dependent variable, everything else about us is different. So looking at an interaction of our block with the treatment, you can't really put that in the model because there's something else in there. That's the error. That's me, you, and you, that we're different. So we can't have any interaction there. So there's no interactions. There's no tau by pi interaction. That's the key. That's the key thing you do, and the problem is, how are you going to know that in advance? You don't. I'll give you an example. Oh, wait a second. If there's interaction, well, then error goes up because there's no place for it to go. It can't go into tau. It can't go into pi. It can't go into mu. There's only one place that thing can live. That's an error. So it makes error go up. We don't want that because that makes the denominator of the fraction bigger for the f, which gives you less power. The nice thing is if you violate the assumptions, you don't make a fool of yourself by saying things are there that aren't there. You make a fool of yourself by missing stuff that's actually there. And that's not nearly as bad. It's much better to say there isn't this than coming out saying, I've discovered something, and it's actually wrong. So it's kind of a good thing in a way. You lose power, in essence, is what's happening here. Basically, don't have interactions in your data. And you're thinking, well, yeah, but how am I going to know? Well, you actually don't know until you've collected the data. And then you still don't really know because it's not in the model, so you can't test it. So how are you going to do it? You're going to do it with exploratory data analysis. See, it all comes together. There's a reason I teach you all these things. Let's say we have a language learning situation. Okay? So you're learning French. We got a small number of subjects. We got 9 subjects, and we think, wait a second, I know something that would be a real nuisance variable: previous experience with French. That's obviously going to play a role, right? Because it might be the case. Let's say if someone is fluently bilingual, trying to teach them French isn't going to help them, no matter what method you use, because they're already pretty good. right? Maybe someone that's gone to, just to say grade 10, that's the requirement, isn't it? You just have to go to grade 10 for French?
Nine?
It's, anyway. Wow. Okay, it was 10 when I was in high school. I stopped in 11 because I couldn't write French. I could speak French just fine, but I can't write it. I said to my teacher, you know, I'm never going to write notes to people. The idea is I want to be able to talk to them and watch their televisions. Anyway. Some people stop in grade 9, grade 10. Some people maybe went to they finished high school French all the way to grade 12. Okay? So we got low, medium, and high, we'll call those. And you might think that the low people aren't going to probably learn anything. The high people, you never know. Maybly they haven't spoken. I'm not talking about fluently bilingual, maybe people that went to French immersion, whatever. And there's people in the middle. And we got three methods of teaching. One is the one that we all had in high school, which is the one where the teacher stands there and makes you conjugate verbs, where you don't learn a thing. Je suis, tu es, il est, nous sommes, vous êtes. You're not learning anything there. I really don't think you are. You're learning to repeat those things, those sounds, incorrectly. Another method might be more interactive approach, you know, where the teacher's talking to you and talking back. And the final method would be one where it's interactive, and it's also interactive within groups of students and interactive with the rest of the class and the teacher, which is sort of the way people are supposed to teach French as a second language, apparently. This is what I've heard from people that have been trained in how to teach French as a second language, those people being my wife. So we have three methods, and we're certainly going to think that previous experience is going to play a role. We're going to measure each person, though. So let's say you three guys are one level, you three guys another, you three guys back here another level. I don't know, so you're the low, you're the medium, you're the high. I don't know if you are, but, you know, whatever. We then take a look at this, and we see with the low level, pretty straight line here. With the medium level, we get quite a jump up here for method three. And the weird thing is, for the high level group, method two doesn't works more poorly than je suis, tu es, il est. But the best method by far, big jump, up here. Now, the thing is, the fact that those lines aren't parallel means there's an interaction. It means, in fact, that there's error you can't account for. The problem is you can't test it. It's not in the model. So what it's going to do is it's going to make error bigger. So this is a real issue, because you're going to do the analysis now, and you'll find out that maybe you find there is an effect of method. In fact, it almost looks like you would, you know? But let's say you didn't find there was an effect. It may be the case that you didn't find there was an effect because there's no effect, or you didn't find there's an effect because there's an interaction there and it's made the error term bigger. So you don't know why you didn't find it. If you find it, you're okay. If you find it, you stop and say, oh, good, it worked. If you didn't find it, you go, oh, hell. Did that happen because I have an interaction here? There's no way for you to know. The only thing you can do is do the experiment again with another set of people. It's the only way you could ever solve that problem. It's not easy. So it's a very useful technique, and I bet here, in fact, it'd be okay. My take usually is, if you have a disordinal interaction, lines cross, be afraid. It's not going to work. But it's a judgment call. Now, you say, what the hell do you do? Well, there's two things you can do. Do the experiment again. Or there are non-parametric tests you can use which aren't very powerful and don't really answer questions very well, but they do tell you if there are differences. And they're very easy to do. They're doable by hand with an abacus. They're about ranks. They're very simple, like the Kruskal-Wallis test, things like that. But it is an issue. These are great designs, but they can be a problem. Questions about that? Oh, you know what you could do? You could have more than one repeated variable. Ooh. So why not, right? So now instead of a, two by three, let's say, instead of a two by three, all different groups, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, why don't we test people in implicit and explicit memory at 1 hour, 5 minutes, 1 hour, and 24 hours? What is stopping you? Nothing I say. Nothing stops you from doing this. The analysis of variance police think this is perfectly fine. Not an old song by Cheap Trick. No, that was Dream Police. That was just for me. It's the first album I ever bought. Dream was 12. All right, so it looks like that. Again, so we got one group of people. We're going to test them at 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours. We're going to give them all implicit and explicit tests at all levels of the independent variable. What's the model here? Wow. It's x equals mu plus alpha plus beta plus alpha beta plus pi plus alpha pi plus beta pi plus alpha beta pi. Which at the end sounded like it might be a Dr. Seuss thing. Is that a wallet in your pocket? Yeah, that one. That's a great Dr. Seuss thing. A toothbrush on your toothbrush or whatever it goes. Yeah. There's some of those I can say totally by heart, reading my kids so many times. You know? Big, brown, big brown bear. Big brown bear, beautiful balloon. Yes?
Is that a three-way?
It's a two-way with repeated measures for subjects. It's the same thing we had before, right? So if you want to think of alpha as being retention interval and beta as being test type, implicit versus explicit, now we have the same subjects, group 1, group 1, group 1, group 1, group 1, group 1. So if what we have here for pi is just the people, individuals, right? So it's not a block sort of thing anymore. Now we're just doing repeated measures on everything. So it's a two-way. You could do it with three. It gets kind of ugly, but the model gets ugly. Right? There's lots of terms here. And there's a lot of potential error terms. If you noticed before, the thing we use as an error term was tau by pi. Oh, so there's one here, there's one here, there's one here, and there's one there. Everything with a random factor in it. What's the random factor? Subjects, pi. What do we test with what? Right? Because do we test the effect of A with what? I don't know. Alpha, beta, pi? Do we have to work out expected values of mean squares for everything? You could, but no, you don't have to. There is a way, a magic way. It feels like magic. So first thing I listed here was S for subjects. Saying we have 10 subjects. I just made that up. That's for the design before. Now we have, so there's 9 degrees of freedom for subjects. The next thing I do is I list a factor. I list my first repeated factor, retention interval. It had three degrees of freedom, sorry, three levels, 5 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours, so 2 degrees of freedom. Don't worry about this column yet. I now go RI by subjects and write that down. The next thing I do is I talk about M for memory. I'm calling it implicit versus explicit. I'm calling the factor M. It has 1 degree degree of freedom, 2 levels. I cross M with S. I cross M with RI, and I cross M with S by RI. I'm done now. I've listed all the sources of variation. The cool thing now you look at the other column, I am able to figure out what to test with what by looking below and seeing what has the thing I'm interested in, let's say retention interval, and subjects in it. The first one below it. Oh, I'll test this with this. I'll test this one with this one. And I'll test this one with this one. Instead of having to actually work out the expected values of the mean squares, this little trick, which is called Yates order, which was developed by a guy named Frank Yates, one of the originators of analysis of variance. So if you've got repeated measures, first thing you list is the subjects. Then you list your repeated factor and cross it with the subjects. Then list the, that's going to, see, so you got RI, then S by RI. M, that's memory. M by S, M by RI, M by S by RI. I'm done. So now I know what to test with what by doing this properly. Yes, ma'am.
So you said you do this instead of doing...
Well, you could work out the expected values of the mean squares and say, okay, well, what am I going to test with what? Right? Because now we've got all these things with subjects in them. If you look at the model, there's one, two, three, four things with pi in them. Do we test S? No, we don't care. First of all, there is no way to test it. There's no error term. And secondly, we don't care. We know people are different from each other. No problem. You might want to just come in and learn some really advanced statistics. It's fun. That is pretty cool because now you don't have to worry about working out the expected values of mean squares. It just comes together. And on that note, packing in for today. Remember, you have a test on Thursday. Thanks, guys.
Podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, Sharealike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right, giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want. Okay. Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.